Karen, do you want to start recording? I'll go ahead and call this meeting to order for the West AC. It's March 16th, 2022, and I'm going to immediately turn this over to Greg Geist.
All right. Thank you, Diana, and welcome, everyone. Good to see you. We have a big meeting tonight. We have two motions for support, hopefully. And I just wanted to start with some good news on the inflow and infiltration intergovernmental agreements with the cities. That will be, in all likelihood, signed by the Board of County Commissioners tomorrow. And we have four of the six cities already signed up. Oregon City it's on their consent agenda for, is it tonight?
Tonight.
And then we're still working with West Lynn, but hopefully they'll be coming on board shortly. So kudos to everyone that's been working on that, especially you, Chris. Thank you. The other thing. So we recently found out, like a couple weeks ago, that Commissioner Rocky Smith is, you know, their commission meetings are on Wednesdays. And we didn't know that. You know, we had a discussion in this group in November of last year, and then we actually sent out a couple doodle polls. But one reason or other, we just found out that because of that schedule, Rocky is unable to attend moving forward. So the main reason why we even had that conversation was because Renee has a conflict on at least, I think it's the third Thursday, which was our old schedule. So we really need to switch back to Thursdays to accommodate the electeds. You know, when we started this schedule, we committed that we would not schedule it over a city commission or council meeting. And our part of that was we overlooked Oregon City. And so we need to figure out whether the second or the third Thursday of the month will work for people moving forward. Lauren, do you want to explain more or take a poll?
I don't know if it's convenient for people or if you're prepared to, you know, say whether the second or third Thursdays work well or if the doodle poll is an option. I can definitely send that out. Sometimes it's hard to get timely responses from everyone, so I don't know if it's easier if anyone has a major conflict to just speak up here.
So, and I guess I would ask before we do that, the second Thursday of the month would work for Rocky and would work for Renee. So if it doesn't work for somebody here, And you can tell us now, then that's great. Oh, I'm seeing lots of thumbs up. So, okay. All right. Well, let's do that then.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Good. Well, that was easy, Greg.
Yeah.
I will say too that I saw Rocky at an event the other night, and I did try to pin him down and ask if he would indeed start attending these since we're moving everything back to Thursdays for him. So he said he would certainly give it his best effort.
Okay.
So this is third Thursdays, did you say?
Second.
Oh, second Thursdays. Okay. Yep. Let's do it.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your flexibility. And that's all I have for my updates for now.
Right. We're going to move on to Aaron Blue talking about our rates.
Hi. Thanks, Diana. Chris is actually going to start the presentation, so I'll hand it over to him.
Okay.
Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And this is the culmination of several different conversations that we have had with this advisory committee, and it's probably one of the bigger questions that we are going to be posing to you, that we have posed to you in quite a while. So we appreciate your thoughtful deliberation and conversation around this. Because it's sort of a comprehensive package, Unlike how we typically approach it, I would suggest that we actually hold questions until the end, because I want to make sure that we have time for deliberation, questions, and everyone getting their pieces together. In part because I also think that Aaron's going to present a lot of fascinating information and we may be tempted to dive down on some of those details, but I want to make sure we hit that big picture. So I think, Lauren, you're running the show. Next slide. So what we're looking at doing here and what we're trying to present to you in a meaningful way is what is the long-term strategy for Wes accomplishing all the things that you have asked us to accomplish? And in doing so, we have to look at a lot of different pieces of the puzzle to try and fit it together. That's what we're trying to present to you tonight. It's how those puzzle pieces fit together so you can see the big picture of how Wes is trying to function in accomplishing what you are asking us to do. So to make sure we all have that context and can have a great conversation, first we're going to go over our strategic goals of what you are asking us to do. Then we're going to go through a brief sort of review of rate making, because I think of all the issues that our customers have, the number one concern they have is what are my rates going to be and how does it, you know, affect my dollar and my pocketbook. So we'll cover that. We'll cover some projections about, you know, what we have and where we're going, at least in our best guesstimate. Then we'll present to you a comprehensive recommendation and an actual resolution that we have prepared for you, along with a memo that summarized the issue that would then be presented to the Board of County Commissioners. Next slide. So to make sure that we're all on the same page, I wanted to just emphasize the direction that we've heard from this committee about what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to go about it. The first, of course, is our job number one is to provide all necessary services to protect public health and water quality. That's job number one. And we've mentioned before that we have other factors that we consider, but our default is if there is a conflict between any other goal and protecting public health comes first. And that is our number one priority and our commitment to you as our customers. But we don't want to do the minimum. We want to be excellent. I believe the phrase that Director Geist uses is a premier utility. So we also want to make sure that we have all the adequate infrastructure available to support economic development. Certainly significant areas of our service geography is experiencing substantial growth, and we want to be able to support that. We also made some significant commitments at the beginning in regionalizing wastewater and surface water services around what went before. And CCSD1, the Rate Zone 2 predecessor, had borrowed money, and one of the commitments in the foundational documents of WES is that only Rate Zone 2 would pay for those legacy debt payments, so we need to honor that commitment and cost allocations. The fourth is, frankly, we want to do all that in the most cost-effective manner possible. We're a nonprofit. We're not looking to get a return on any sort of equity. We don't have any. We just want to operate on a cost basis, so we're trying to make this the most efficient that we can. And finally, earlier in your sort of tenure and direction to Wes, we posed the question of, as we regionalize the services, how should we approach providing those services? How should we view our customers? We actually spent about three different meetings over about 6 months talking through the issue and the different various approaches. And the direction you gave us is people should be charged on the service that they receive, not based on where they live. So we're trying to put all these pieces together in one comprehensive package for you to consider. Next slide. In doing so, like I said, the main point of contact we have with the vast majority of our customers, and by the way, y'all are special because you get the, you know, peek behind the curtain and you understand the details at a far greater level than the average customer that Wes experiences. And in fact, that's why we want you here, is because you have that depth of insight and we want to have that conversation with you. But since most people just care about rates and making sure that when their toilet flushes, there's not a problem, that is going to be a primary point of focus in this conversation. Where we go with rates drives a lot of other decisions and pieces of the puzzle. And so we're going to walk through having stable, predictable rates, which is a goal that you also gave us, and that we wanted to avoid rate shock. for those of you who don't recall the dark days of the near moratorium in 2007, 2008, CCSD1's rates nearly doubled in 3 years to accomplish a significant capital program to ensure that we had the capacity to support current and future customers. So we want to avoid that. We want to make it nice and smooth. We want to make sure that cost recovery is based on the service, as stated before, and that there's stability and predictability in how we do about these, go about these things, so you don't see emergency calls for cash or, you know, extraordinary circumstances where there has to be a significant change down the line. So with that, now Aaron is going to walk through a bit more specifically our rate profile and some of the assumptions behind it.
Thank you, Chris. This is really just an informational slide and kind of a reminder of WES's current sanitary sewer rates. And this provides some context for the proposed adjustments that are discussed later in the presentation. So WES's current sanitary sewer rates consist of three different components, with customers charged based on the service they received. The wastewater treatment component applies to all customers in WES's sewer service area. The local collection component applies to customers in unincorporated Clackamas County and Happy Valley. The other cities in WES's sewer service area have their own collection systems and provide for and charge for their collection service separately. And then, as Chris mentioned on our prior slide, WES's sanitary sewer rate also includes a legacy debt service component, which applies only to customers in rate zone 2, including Johnson City and the city of Milwaukee. Those components in the current fiscal year are $25.30 for wastewater treatment, $13.50 for local collection, and the legacy debt service fee is at $12.65. A customer in unincorporated Clackamas County in rate zone 2 would pay all three of those for a total of $51.45. All right, next slide, please. These next few slides, as Chris was mentioning, cover a summary of the projections that we used in developing the proposed strategy. Our annual operating budget is currently approximately $24 million per year. Labor costs are a little over 50% of that budget. For long-range planning purposes, we're projecting a 6% growth in annual labor costs, and that's fairly conservative. With adjusting for changes in our total number of employees over the past few years, we've seen an actual change in labor from 0.6% to 7%, with a five-year average growth of 4% and a three-year average growth of 2.7%. So 6% is a good conservative number for use in these projections. Materials and services costs, the other component of WES's operating budget, are projected to grow between 3 to 4.5% per year. Utilities are at the higher end of that range at 4.5%, and other supplies, such as repair and maintenance supplies, are projected to grow at about 3% per year. In the broader economic spectrum, we've been experiencing the highest inflation since 1982. The latest numbers were 7.9% for the consumer inflation index. And while we're keeping a really close eye and monitoring these conditions, we aren't projecting, changing these assumptions at this time, as most economists are projecting that inflation is going to return to a more normal level by the end of this calendar year. So we're just keeping an eye on things for now, but we aren't changing our base assumptions. We are working to maintain the current number of full-time employees. If WES didn't have any vacancies, we would have 116 employees, and the projections don't anticipate adding to that. WES has a practice to transfer all operating income that's not needed for debt service or operating expenses to the construction fund, where it can be used to fund capital projects. To the extent that all other variables are held steady, if operating expenses increase, it decreases the amount of funds that we have left over to transfer to the construction fund. Next slide, please. Over the next 10 years, we're projecting funding $349 million in capital expenditures on the sewer side. Those projections are targeting about $34.9 million per year, with some potential differences in year-to-year spending based on the timing of capital projects. And you may notice that this figure is higher than the annual target of $33 million shared in the January presentation, and that's due to incorporation of some unused capital funds from last fiscal year and projected unused funds from the current fiscal year. So that increases the amount we have available for future years. That $34.9 million also includes the amounts of WES's contributions for the regional I&I agreement. So we have about $15 million for the next five fiscal years related to WES's contributions for that. As recommended by the advisory committee last year, WES implemented a financial strategy to repay debt to the extent eligible with SDC fees. And that strategy takes a lot of pressure off of WES's rates. Approximately $8.7 million of our current debt service is SDC eligible, and we are making transfers from the SDC fund to the debt service fund to make those payments. Our projections are assuming that we continue to transfer funds from the SDC fund to make those debt service payments. Our bond covenants require annual net operating revenues, which is just gross revenues less operating expenses, to be a minimum of 1.2 times our annual debt service. Our actual debt coverage ratio for last fiscal year was 4.17, so it's quite a bit higher than the required 1.2. The difference between that 4.17 and 1.2 required rate represents WES's capacity to issue new debt. Part of that capacity was utilized with the issuance of the 2021 series. We only made an interest payment on that debt last year in June. This year, we're making full debt service on that, so our estimated coverage ratio is projected to be around 2.7 for the current fiscal year, rather than that higher amount of 4.17 last fiscal year. Future borrowings are assumed at 3.5%. That's fairly conservative as well. Our existing borrowings range between, have an average of 2.2% on the 2016 refunding. 2021, of course, we realized an amazing low interest rate of just 0.84%. And the state loan financings are issued at 0 to 2.14% interest. So 3.5% is a good number for use in long-term financial planning. Next slide, please. So we are currently, WES is in a really strong financial position with intentionally built reserves to fund our capital projects. At the end of this fiscal year, we're projecting having $94 million in the Capital Construction Fund and $47 million in the SDC Fund. At a capital expenditure rate of around $34.9 million per year, though, that reserve is going to be spent down over the next five fiscal years. And at that point, we'll be borrowing. So we'll be issuing debt to make up the difference to fund the CIP. And those borrowings are estimated at about $30 million per year. We might not borrow $30 million every year. We might borrow more one year or another and none the following year. But just for the projection model, we're assuming that the difference between existing reserves and total capital expenditures is made up with debt. We are considering SRF funding as well as the federal funds that are made available through the bipartisan infrastructure law. And we'll really be pursuing the lowest cost financing, whichever mechanism we need to use to achieve that. Next slide, please. All right, I'm going to hand this back over to Chris.
Thank you, Erin. That's super informative, and I strongly suspect that many people had some questions that you wanted to ask around those assumptions, and that's why I asked you to hold, because I didn't want to stop there without giving you the big picture conclusion of what we use those assumptions to build towards. As a reminder, this committee gave us a direction about rate adjustments and said minimum of inflation and a maximum of 10%. And I will note that we have followed that with one exception. During the pandemic, we actually recommended a below inflation rate increase. So we have tried to the extent we're being inconsistent with this policy, we're on the low end, and internal conversations right now suggest that we may do the same thing because, as Erin noted, inflation is extraordinary right now. And our proposal of levelized 5% rate increases would put us below the rate of inflation for this year. And we think hopefully that will stabilize itself. But part of this projection and planning exercise is it's an average across 10 years, not in any one given year. And we think that that glide path will be sustainable for both our operations, debt service, and capital construction programs. the I should note, in fairness to Lynn and Jessica and others that are here, part of this conversation and what it drove was a conversation around the CIP and how to fit those pieces together. Projects, you know, shifted timing, priority, how the scope of some of them, I think, were looked at. So in essence, we were trying to identify, consistent with those five strategic goals, what is the best sort of mix? And then we all had to live within our means, right? We basically did an iteration and then worked backwards and said, okay, let's adjust the capital plan. Let's adjust our operating budget. Let's look at how we're managing our debt service, and made it all fit together so it was harmonized and all those pieces could be brought together and presented to you. Next slide. So one thing that I want to emphasize is in this approach, what we're trying to do is be consistent and level across time to the magic point. Well, I think in the memo I call it the inflection point of rate harmonization. So what we're seeing here is a 5% increase in the wholesale treatment rate and the collection system treatment rate. And right now, when I say rate harmonization, it's because the legacy debt actually results in differential payments total. As Aaron noted, that our unincorporated ratepayers are paying 50-some dollars. That is, if you had the retail customers in rate zone one, which we actually have some, pay substantially less than that. They pay, I think, just under $40 a month. I'm looking at Aaron and she's nodding. So people are receiving the same service, but they're paying different rates. And that's because of the legacy debt. So as we are going down this glide path, we're, because of growth, because of SDC income, we are shrinking the amount that has to be collected for that legacy debt component until the magic moment in the 2030-31 fiscal year where we can eliminate that component of our rate and everyone is just paying the same. And what that means is you will see rate changes, you might say percentage changes, that are different based on your geography, because we're basically, it's aligning everyone to end up at the same point in the future. And that's what we're going through. I also wanted to be transparent that part of this plan is, and frankly, it was something that both Doug Waugh and I were very proud, is to get that AAA bond rating and being able to go out like last year and get that 0.84%. I'm pretty pleased from a money management standpoint of being able to do that and having that sort of credit rating. And this plan spends that political capital, you might say. You know, the rating is only as good as what it brings you, and what it's going to bring us is the ability to borrow the money that we need to accomplish the capital improvement plan. And so we are anticipating that we would, as we go through and execute this plan, experience some degree of downgrading in our rating and pay a bit more in interest rates. Next slide. We wanted to give you a visual of what it looks like when we talk about this rate harmonization and the rate components. And as you can see, as more customers are joining rate zone two, as additional revenue comes in, the net, we are operating on a net revenue requirement, right? We need an absolute dollar figure from rate zone two to make their legacy debt payments. So as more people join, we reduce the amount that we have to collect from everybody because more people are paying. And as that experiences, part of the pleasant surprise, and one of the reasons why this is a strategy and not just a duh, this is what you do, is because in addition to the growth and the experience that we're seeing on the monthly rate, we're getting SDC revenues. And as you'll note, the harmonization is in 2031. The debt actually gets retired in 2036. So we can stop collecting in 2031, in part because of the policy that you authorized of using SDC revenue to make payments for debt service. And enough of the debt is eligible for SDC repayment that the last 5 years is going to be paid through SDC revenues alone, and we don't have to put it on the monthly rates. So our focus has been to try and get that legacy debt addition on the monthly rates out as soon as we can. Next slide. I just covered the first bullet, so everyone's going to be paying the same. Some capital projects I will note in the capital plan that Lynn will be sharing with you and always updates every year are on the retail side of the house. So we assign that debt to the various rate components. If it is a capital project that supports retail, then only the retail rate will pay for that strand of debt service. We don't lump everyone together. It's based on the cost of service. Now, I will say that the vast majority of our infrastructure and investment is around the wholesale rate. So you will see the vast majority of debt associated there. We will have a separate conversation around surface water. Ron will be presenting, I think, very soon now, the master plan that he's been working on for a while now on surface water and how those services can be integrated and operated on a regional basis. And that will be integrated into it. But from a overall picture of Wes's financial strategy, because so much of our resources is focused on wastewater, we didn't want to wait. We wanted to get this in front of you and get your feedback. And ultimately, we are trying to reflect the values and direction that you as the advisory committee have given us. And we hope that this is a reasonable reflection of that direction. I believe that is the last slide.
All right. Are there questions from the team?
Yeah.
William?
Different practice for me to hold back. Thanks for monitoring me, Chris. The first thing was the concept that rates are, quote, based on services received. I just want us to think about that phrase, because it seems to me as though some of our rates are also based on services that we expect to receive. That is to say, as we improve things, we need to pay for them as well. When we say that we are basing our rates on services received, it all sounds in the past tense.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I guess the way I would reflect that back is that distinction for us is between wholesale and retail and surface water. And both of those, when I say the wholesale rate, that's the service you're receiving. It's both current operations and future investment. So the rate profile incorporates both a present and future tense. But you're right that we should be careful in how we phrase that.
Yeah, I'm just suggesting that that be one thing you consider when you put this message out there, that it's not just on services received. For example, STCs are not services received. They're services expected to be needed.
They're payments for services, or you might say infrastructure, already built. Because certainly in our sewer world, we build it first and then they come. We're the field of dreams approach to infrastructure.
Yeah. What are SRF loans?
That is the Clean Water Act State Revolving Fund loans. So the federal government distributes annually to each state a pot of money that's then made available for them to loan out to support drinking water, surface water, wastewater projects that would might otherwise have trouble receiving investments. Right now, it's some of the cheapest money out there. We were able to access it to support the solids handling project. And in part, we did that because it had I'm going off a little bit, but I just love talking about it because it was such a great deal. It has a sponsorship option where if we were doing a project in a different category of water, they basically reduced our interest rate to 1%. And so we signed up for that, and that has actually enabled $1.4 million to be available to support our Three Creeks water quality improvement projects that Ron has been, I think, presenting. I don't know if he's presented that to this group recently, but it's the next major capital project that surface water is.
Okay, you're just bragging now. I understand what SRF is, but I do want to verify that those are for water projects only.
Yes.
Okay, so The last issue that I wanted to chat with you about was the concept of the relationship, the calculus, between SDCs and rates. So it sounds as though in an ideal world, everything would be paid by SDCs. And yet, I think that has a downside to it as well that we have to recognize, that that does impact the actual development that we may be wanting to encourage, or some may be wanting to encourage.
Absolutely. And I will note that to remind this group of another conversation that you did have about 2.5 years ago, we went through a pretty robust conversation around the capital improvement plan and what the SDC eligible amount that we could charge would be. And after extensive dialogue, we actually ended up charging less than the full SDC. Remember, we brought in those rate models that showed the differential between if we collected the max and we collected and we compared ourselves against neighboring jurisdictions. I also, because I can't stop talking, William, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
Emphasize that.
I'll stop you when I'm tired.
I also want to emphasize the challenge of, in essence, we use SDCs to repay rates for infrastructure projects. Because we have to pre-construct everything, we don't actually collect the SDCs related to that infrastructure until after we've already built it. So we use rate dollars to construct the infrastructure, then we use the SDC dollars to repay the ratepayers for their advance, in essence, of that investment, which is one of the reasons why when you borrow money, we want to use those SDCs to repay that debt, because, you know, the entire bill hasn't come due, and the people that pay the SDCs and now the monthly rates, they should be paying into that cost of service.
And there's a, well, this is another, I'll save that sidetrack into the philosophy of SDCs and its impact on growth, but thanks for those answers.
Anyone else?
I'm finished.
Okay. All right. I'm just making sure, William. You had a list.
For now.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions for Chris or Aaron?
Yeah.
Renee?
I have a question around the bond covenants. Just trying to wrap my head around this. When I was reading the material, it sounded like the covenant is that revenue is 1.2 times expenses. But then I heard Aaron say debt service. So the reason I'm asking this is, or trying to get clarification on this, is thinking about if we're able to get federal dollars for some of the capital projects, does that offset expenses, and how does that play into overall financial projections?
Sure. And I'm going to let Aaron answer this question.
Sure. It's a great question. So I think the memo may have said like certain expenses. And so the covered ratio is 1.2 times the debt service expenses in any fiscal year. And that's revenues, which is total gross revenues. So all revenues from all sources, including SDCs, less operating expenses. And that represents the amount of money that we have available for debt service and other obligations. And that's what anyone that borrows money, any of our stakeholders want to ensure that we have enough capacity to meet our debt obligations and to pay the service on our bonds. If a portion, so under the State Revolving Fund Loan Program, there's a potential for West to have principal forgiveness. So if we obtain financing and that financing qualified for principal forgiveness, mm-hmm. it could potentially reduce the anticipated debt service that we have. And it, so it wouldn't impact our coverage ratio as much. We wouldn't have as many debt service expenses. So we could meet those with existing net operating revenues. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think it does. What I was, I think, getting stuck on was if actual expenses for capital projects were changing, that would, you know, throw things off a little bit. But it sounds like that's not the issue at all. It's just the debt.
Yeah, it is a good point, though. One thing I didn't mention that the memo did a good job of covering is that in any year where WES's net operating revenues don't equal the minimum required coverage ratio of 1.2, the difference to bring WES's coverage ratio up to 1.2 would need to be recovered through rates. And I think the memo did a good job of kind of summarizing that relationship. It becomes an additional revenue requirement to ensure that we meet coverage.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
And to put the, you might say, in dollar figures, Aaron mentioned that our current debt service total payments is around 13 point, I'm blanking on the point, around 13 million. Let's use the rough.
13.2.
So we are generating enough revenue so that when you subtract out our operating expenses, we have to be generating that 13.2 plus 20%. So another $2.6 million of revenue has to come in that is not committed to the operating budget, right? And that's sort of the key distinction that you have to make. It can't be, oh, we're generating the extra money, so we're going to spend it this year. It's you're generating the extra money so that you have buffer to make sure you can make the payment to the bondholders. And it's an annual test. So we generate an extra $2.6 million in revenue this year. And what do we do at the end of the year? We put it in the bank so we can spend it the next year. But then we have to generate that 2.6 all over again the following year. Each year we have to prove to the bondholders that our coverage ratio is being met.
I have a question under assumptions in the memo. It says that some service and materials costs are currently increasing faster, obviously, due to everything that's happening. It's your assumption that the cost will decrease at some point in the next 10 years to result in this 4.8 average. Have you ever seen prices come down once they hit a certain point? I'm just curious because I see things leveling off, but I do you see materials actually coming down in price? Go ahead, Lynn.
In the recession in the 2008-2012, prices went way down. Smart people were building things at 60 to 70% of the previous cost.
Okay, that's good. That's actually very great news to hear that that could actually happen. So just
not that I would wish a recession on us, but.
No, I know. That was an extreme time as well. And Greg Geist, thank you for that answer.
Yeah, we'll guarantee you future results.
Exactly. So Chris and or Aaron, I just wanted to maybe preview what that retirement of the debt service and the rate profile trajectory is going to look like for the rate zone two folks. So the thing is we're levelizing rates. We're having a consistent rate increase, but we're also factoring in the fact that that debt service is slowly being retired. So Chris, can you talk a little bit about that?
I can, and in fact, it'd probably be the easiest to do so, Lauren, if we brought the slideshow back up, and I think it was the third to last slide with the graphic of the bars showing the rate profile approach right here. So what you're seeing is the blue, which is the wholesale treatment rate, that's going up at 5% a year. Now, some of our customers, Gladstone, for example, this is the only piece of our rate profile that they pay. So they will see an adjustment of 5% per year for their wholesale rate that WES charges for services, and the city adds on what they need to manage their collection system. The green, which is the local collection system, is also going up at 5% per year, and that's doing a lot of the work that we are anticipating around I&I improvements, line cleanings, et cetera, et cetera. And so that continues on an arc right there. And those are rate zone two for the most part. There is a portion of rate zone one that pays collection system. There is a about 1,000 people and 400 or so EDUs just outside of Oregon City. But the yellow, as we shrink it, is basically a counteracting impact on the rate increases for the rate zone two ratepayers. So rate zone one, while paying lower absolute numbers will see their rates increase at 5% a year. Rate zone two folks, while paying a higher absolute amount, will see their rates increase at a much lower rate. It could be, we're depending on where you are, because there's also some right-of-way fees and some other pieces that'll be floating around there, could be between 1.8% and Johnson City and Milwaukee, zero, because they don't pay the collection system portion of it, just the wholesale rate. The decreases in the legacy debt actually offset entirely the rate increase on the wholesale rate. So Johnson City and Milwaukee are actually looking at 0% rate adjustments for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I just want to be clear and transparent about that and why that works the way that it does. And it's because they paid for that wastewater treatment component, $130 million, and are paying that legacy debt moving forward. So,
yeah, and I actually perked up when Lynn was talking about the impacts of the recession, because that's exactly when we built that phase one expansion. And it did significantly bring the cost of the estimated cost of that project down by a couple tens of millions of dollars as we go through. And while our numbers don't exactly assume it, frankly, we are presuming that at some point in the next 10 years, there will be a recession that will have a counteracting effect on the inflationary pressure that we're seeing right now. Thank you, Lauren. I think we can drop the slide.
All right. Anyone else? Craig DiLoretto?
Yeah, well, I mean, if we're done with the discussion, I was going to make a motion to recommend approval to the county commissioner, the Board of County Commissioners, the proposed financial plan as presented to us this evening.
I'd second that motion.
We have a motion from Greg DiLoretto and a second from William. Any other discussion? I think we're going to do a yay by thumbs up. Thank you. Any nays? Very good. All right, motion passes. So Chris and Aaron, thank you very much. This has been a very enlightening discussion that we've had for several months. But I think we made it to the finish line. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to Ron, rules and regulations.
Yeah, thank you, Diana. And hopefully we can keep up some finish line momentum. I like to say that we're kind of in the home stretch on the rules, although certainly want to flag that there is a lot of work to do and a lot more process before we actually get to said finish line. What we've been talking to the committee about for quite some time is really just the key policy changes that we're proposing, really the direction for us to create the words to enact those policies, and we hope to continue that discussion tonight. Next slide, please. So tonight we will again just touch on project background, because people come and go with these meetings, and then after that really focus on four of the key policy recommendations that we made that at our last meeting, our last advisory committee meeting, when we had discussion about those key policies, there were several questions on these items in particular. So we have been working on those and revising our proposals and hope to revisit those tonight and work towards your concurrence. And again, that's overarching. We are seeking a recommendation this evening that we can have the advisory committee concur with those key policy changes so we can move forward, continuing to write the rules and standards and to engage the county commissioners in the ordinance adoption. Next slide. So again, just the background, just to really keep touching on this, that this is because of the municipal partnership that joined all of our districts together, and recognizing that each of our districts had previously separate rules and standards, that this is our opportunity to unite and align all of those standards into one set of rules and regulations and associated standards. And so it's a full repeal and a full replace. It's challenging to talk about because while all of the words are new in new documents, they may not be entirely new, but we have to make sure that people understand what it is that we're actually proposing in our new sets of rules and standards. Next slide. We've been at it for a while. Again, we started the process with listening to folks to say, hey, as we unite these rules and standards from all of our separate service districts, what else should we be looking at? And we heard both internally to our organizations and our partner cities, both our wholesale and our retail cities, we heard quite a few things. We had over 50 recommendations of policies that we should probably consider. And then as we've developed those and vetted those over time, we've been sort of building to the point to where the words and the documents really manifest. So we're still in that sort of last phase. We did a public review in April of 2020. We're still at it in terms of writing the language for the rules and regulations, and we're really pushing towards advisory committee concurrence and then the board engagement process. Next slide. And again, we presented this last time too. We've had a lot of touch points with the community on these policies and received input along the way. And it's really helped us shape something that will be acceptable and effective and meet our intent for the services we provide. Next slide. So while obviously none of the policies are off the table, the last time we spoke about some of the key policies, there were four that emerged just based on questions and feedback that people had that we wanted to revisit tonight. And so there we'll kind of step through those. Next slide. The first one, and this is the only one in one of the standards documents, is the sanitary service connection responsibilities. So the issue as we presented it last time was that there is a significant risk and burden on the district for primarily operation and maintenance of service connections, from building connections to our mainline connections, that our current policy allows for, and that about 10 years ago, the district assumed ownership and operational responsibility for all service connections inside right-of-way and easements. So we'll talk about that in a second. What we presented previously was that we would transfer ownership back to private property owners for those service connections, but the concern that came up from the advisory committee was potentially a significant burden on private property owners or private connections for repairs, particularly in the right-of-way, under streets and sidewalks. It might be overly burdensome. Our current policy, like as I said, is that owners are responsible to easement or right-of-way lines, and that Wes is responsible to the main line. And what we had proposed was that owners would be responsible for, would own the service connections and be responsible for operating and maintaining and repairing structural defects in those service connections within right-of-way and easement. And that was a sticking point, certainly for the advisory committee, and we understood that. One of the things we have changed is that we are still sticking with ownership and responsibility for operation and maintenance of the service connection to the connection with the public main line, we do recognize the potential for undue hardship for private property owners for structural defects, repairing structural defects in the right-of-way. So we're now proposing that the district would be responsible for repairing those structural defects in the right-of-way under streets and sidewalks. And if we can step to the next slide, I worked with Jessica Rinner to help sort of characterize the issue. This is a graphic of basically a typical building connection to the sanitary sewer system. And one of the challenges that we have that is really driving the concern around operation and maintenance is that because the district had the policy previously that owners were responsible all the way to for service connections all the way to the main line, that there aren't often cleanouts built at the right-of-way and or easement lines where the district can easily and efficiently access the line to do O&M. The majority of our connections actually only have cleanouts either at the building or within the building, and we don't actually have the ability to maintain those service connections when something that happens that might is probably going to be likely due to how the service connection was used that needs to be addressed. We have at the time when we started this policy, close to 20,000 connections, 18,500 connections that really can only be accessed through private property. And since that time, we've started requiring cleanouts at right-of-way and easement lines, we only have about 4,000 of those. So we're really just sort of reverting the O&M responsibility back to the connection owner, but recognizing that responsibility for repair in the right-of-way. Next slide. So again, just stepping back to the slide on the proposal, structural defects will be defined in the rules and regulations, and those will be determined by the district. And where they occur inside of right-of-way and right-of-way only, then the district will make those repairs. We're not proposing at this point that the district make those repairs within easements, because easements are still on private property and often not under streets and sidewalks, and technically shouldn't have anything in them because they're easements that are dedicated for access to those main lines. And so that would still be the responsibility of the property owner. But we do certainly recognize the challenges of repairing structural defects under streets and sidewalks. And so the district would be responsible for that. Are there any questions on this particular policy?
Yeah, one briefly.
Yeah.
William, go ahead.
About the cost of repairs, things seem pretty clear, but I didn't hear any reference to a requirement for timeliness. Is there any consideration as to how soon repairs have to be made? Is that a legitimate question?
Oh yeah, it's definitely a legitimate question. We don't have anything in our section on responsibilities for O&M and responsibilities for repairs. We don't have anything in there on timeliness, William. Certainly something to consider if it becomes an issue. You know, a lot of what we are looking at when it comes to either operational responsibility, somebody has a backup, and that just, you know, those tend to get dealt with pretty quickly. A lot of the structural repairs come from real estate transactions, and you know, those often need to be dealt with prior to, you know, those transactions happening. And so there is a sense of urgency there, but we currently don't have anything in the rules or in the standards in terms of timeliness. So that's something I will certainly look at.
Thank you.
Is it too vague to say within a reasonable amount of time, to leave it a little bit open? Or Greg DeLuera is shaking his head no?
Yeah, I don't think you need it. I think Ron said it's kind of unlike in the water system where we do require you to do it in a certain period of time. If you don't fix this thing up, the sewer's backing up into your house. And so you have your own set of timeliness that's already put upon you. If it's a structural defect on your own piece of property, that's also an issue. Actually, the structural defect timeliness of it might be on the district side, you know, because if they don't fix it and there's a route into that side of the district side, and then it starts causing the sewer to back up onto your property, that would be more of an issue. But that's really the district's issue, and probably wouldn't be in the rules and regulations to have a rule on the district that they have to fix it within, I don't know, whatever the number is. I don't see timeliness for sewers the issue that it is for other utilities where you actually don't have the utility. In this case, you got to get it fixed or you've got sewage going all over the place in your house. I think we're pretty good in my sense of it.
I'm just thinking that as a loophole, we could use a phrase such as time is of the essence.
You could, but what if they don't? I mean, what if they don't? What's the thing if they don't fix it right away? The thing if they don't fix it right away is they got sewage in their house. Then they have a health hazard problem, and now you've got other laws that will come into effect. You can't occupy the facility if you can't get access to a sewer that's working. So we can, but I don't know that we necessarily need to. And whatever we put in there will then be open into interpretation from a legal perspective. If somebody doesn't follow the rule, then we got to go through that. It, to me, I mean, it's not make or break for me, but I just.
Just one.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, we'll certainly consider that. It's a good point. We might be able to just at least identify who drives the timeline and something along the lines of, you know, is it on the timeline or is it on the timeline as determined by the district, put it in our own control if possible, but certainly something that we'll look at.
Okay.
Any other questions on the service connection? Go ahead, Greg.
Not a question, but I did want to say that I did want to say you addressed, I raised this issue early on, and I think you addressed the concerns that I had over who was going to have to pay for the repairs and how they would get done. So I'm satisfied with this particular one.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I know Christopher Bowker is not here tonight, and I believe Anthony also expressed some concerns about it. And they were similar. And I think we certainly understand that. So that was the change in the proposal.
Okay.
All right. Moving on. The presentation. Oh, there we go. We're coming back. Thank you, Lauren. Moving on to the next one. Next slide. So annexation into the district. You know, something that seems relatively simple can be also extremely complicated. But to revisit what we had talked about here initially is that, we when there are requests to annex into the district, over time, Wes has worked closely with the cities on and the cities that we serve on really the orderly process of development and also the city's interest in having properties annexed into cities in order to provide urban services. We haven't had in our CCSD1 rules or our Tri-City rules policy on annexation into the district. There was a conversation with the Board of County Commissioners in 2013 and a memorandum that was prepared that provided direction to us to require properties wishing to annex into the district to first request annexation into a city. And it's been going pretty well. There are not having that actually codified in our rules has been challenging at times, but we generally work through it. So while we're doing this update now, we have added a section into the rules on annexation and really around, the process of annexing into cities prior to annexing into the district and receiving services from the district. Our current policy, again, which is not in our rules, is that they must first seek annexation into a city. And if they don't, then it's still up to the district discretion and also where there are limited circumstances, such as either the sewer service is readily available or there's a public health hazard. There's sort of wide discretion, I would say, for the district to either provide services in an extraterritorial sense or to annex properties into the district. What we're proposing, or I guess I'll touch on what we had proposed last time was really just sort of taking the intent of the policy memo, bringing it into the rules, and saying that lands, properties seeking annexation into the district first needed to ask a city. And then if they said no, then the district would decide. And I think the feedback from the advisory committee was that we should detail that a little bit more and create some criteria about when we would, when the district would and when the district wouldn't annex properties into a city, I mean, into the district if a city said no. And so that's what we did in the latest iteration. And I had provided that language from that section of the rules in the memo that's in your packet. And generally that we created some criteria for different situations. The challenge with annexations is while the bulk of the annexations will fall just sort of into a central tendency of it's right outside a city. You have to first seek annexation into a city and then go from there, depending on what they say, to also making sure that we can account for likely unusual and limited circumstances of situations that are slightly different. And we don't want to manage to the margins, but we really do feel that in the rules and regulations, we need to make sure that we provide for those situations and have a relatively clear path forward. So for now, what we're saying is that if a property is currently, or proposing is if the property is currently outside of the district boundary and not in an incorporated city boundary, then the property owner must first seek annexation into the appropriate city. We will not process a petition for annexation until a city has either approved it or denied annexation. And we wrote in a provision that a city could deny annexation into a city, but still consent to annexation into the district, and then the district would consider that. We wrote that if land, and that's really around lands that are inside of a city's urban growth management area or inside of an urban growth management agreement and really an area of interest by a particular city, or part of a comprehensive plan where that land is designated to be annexed into a city. But if those criteria are not met, then we added a section in the rules that said the district may still annex properties if they're contiguous with a district boundary. So what we're really trying to do there, and this is we're trying to account for properties that are contiguous with the district, and a lot of them are central to the district where they're holes. They're essentially holes in the district for properties that are not connected to sewer or stormwater. They're not receiving their services, but they still need to be connected at some point, and a city may really not be interested in annexing them. I'm sort of thinking of an area right around I-205 that is sort of in between Happy Valley and Milwaukee. There are still quite a few properties in that area that are not inside the district or inside a city, and just flat out saying that if you can't annex into a city, you can't annex into a district would be highly limiting for people. So we are saying if you are currently touching a district boundary, even if a city says no, and these other conditions like not being in an urban growth management agreement area of interest or a comp plan, then the district has a discretion. We will still ask that they seek annexation into a city, but we have to be able to accommodate connections in those situations where there's no city is going to annex these properties. And then lastly, I'll just touch on, there's always the last provision, which is the public health hazard, where the provision where if a property owner is seeking to annex into the district to abate a public health hazard, that regardless of these other things, it's district discretion to provide extraterritorial service if it doesn't make sense to be in the district, and we've done that before, or annex a property into the district. I want to just show a couple of quick examples of what this looks like. So next slide, Lauren. So this is a property, the property right in the middle there is that looks like a bunch of dirt, because it is. It's the gravel quarry. It's Portland Road and Gravel down off of Jennifer Street, right next to the Clackamas River. This is an area that these properties are currently not in our district and also not in a city. It's an unincorporated Clackamas County. These are property that you can also see the sort of the light blue coloration to the west or left of those properties is actually the city of Happy Valley that have come down 106th Avenue to Jennifer and brought in some properties off of Robert Avenue. So when these properties come to annex into the district, as we sort of run these through the policy as we've laid it out, would first need to seek annexation into Happy Valley if they're part of their urban growth management area and or part of their comprehensive plan, lands to be annexed through their to be annexed in the city or served by the city through the comprehensive plan, then if the city of Happy Valley said no, then we would not annex this property into the district either, unless the city of Happy Valley consents to that annexation. That's kind of how that plays out. Hypothetically, if it's not in the city's UGMA or in a comprehensive plan, this would go to that that provision number 5 that we wrote into this section of the rules that says if it's contiguous with the district boundary, which it is, then the district would consider annexation. So this is kind of one of those critical pieces that here's a property that someday will redevelop. Sanitary sewer service is available on Jennifer Avenue. They are contiguous with the district boundary. So even if Happy Valley said no, this would be a situation that the district would still be able to, at its discretion, consider annexation. Next slide. This is another property, more residential in nature. This is in Happy Valley. Again, just another example. It's just off of 172nd Avenue. And then I think that's Hagen Road that's sort of off to the left. The red, by the way, the red lines on these maps, I should probably explain it because I didn't provide a legend. The red lines and dots on these map are our sanitary sewer, our wastewater system, and the green dots on the map and lines are our stormwater system. So these properties, which are currently farm, rural, residential, that at some point, if they sought annexation into the district to connect to the line that's in 172nd Avenue, they would have to first seek annexation into Happy Valley. Happy Valley is surrounding this site, but if for some reason they decided that they would not provide service, this property is also contiguous with the district boundary, so it would be a district decision if Happy Valley said no, and if they didn't consent to annexation, because we could reasonably provide service, but we would certainly first seek annexation into the city, and frankly, I don't know why the city would say no. Same for the previous property. Next slide. So again, just revisiting the proposal, we've laid it out in a way that we think we can cover the majority of annexation requests, that we will work closely with our partner cities to make sure that where appropriate, properties are first annexing into the cities, but also I think have provided some off-ramps in events like public health hazards and other times when we're trying to fill holes within the district. Are there any questions on annexations?
Michael? Wait, Michael, you need to unmute. Sorry.
2 years into this thing, and I can't remember to do that. I don't know if you know or not. This is more informational. But there is a movement to reincorporate parts of Damascus. So I don't know if that would affect this or not, but it's just kind of a heads up that we heard in the Planning Commission meetings that people are trying to reform Damascus.
So it does affect it in a legal sense, because the initiative that was filed basically puts a stop to anyone annexing into Happy Valley right now. So the city of Happy Valley has received probably 6 annexation requests that they can accept them, but they cannot process them until this initiative, they have gathered the signatures and it makes the ballot. But just by turning in the initiative, the SEL, it stops the process from Happy Valley processing any annexations. So it's a whole big thing. I'd hate to say I'm not involved, but I'm terribly involved, and my phone and emails are blowing up. So, but this it's a real pie in the sky plan that this guy has to do this. He's taking the existing properties that have annexed into Happy Valley. If you look at this map, there's no line, there's no delineation. It's like somebody threw something against the wall, and it's crazy. So, but it has to go through this process because he's trying to get it on the November ballot, and he has 6 months to gather 875 signatures. So, yeah, it's gonna slow down the process of anyone trying to annex into Happy Valley. But I'm sure there's workarounds. In the meantime, you know, I would think.
And I would just add, so Diana Diana and I have talked about this, and we'll look into it. Unfortunately, our lawyer is on vacation this week, and so we'll figure it out. Because it's not a city, we may need to tweak the rules accordingly, but it's not pressing, I would say.
Okay, anyone else? Questions? Greg DiLoreto, did you have another question?
I had a question. Yeah, Ron, I thought I had this under control. The two examples that you showed.
Oh, no, Ron.
But the two examples that you showed are large parcels of land. If they don't annex into a city, are they eligible to develop at urban densities outside of a city under county zoning? And I guess if the answer is yes, then I'm kind of back to my original concern about hooking them up to the sewer system. I can see hooking up the original house. But if we go back to this day where we had urbanized unincorporated areas, we kind of get away from that total concept that cities did city stuff and counties did county stuff. And I'll tell you, that is my bias, having spent 17 years as a city engineer and public works director. But my question is, can those be developed under a county urbanization if the city says no?
Well, I can tell you, I'll answer with how we've currently written that section in the rules, and then I'll let Chris talk. But the way we've written the rules currently, yes, those properties would be able to develop and connect. But it's a very highly limited circumstance, in that if those properties are within a city's urban growth management area or in their comprehensive plan as lands that are intended to annex into cities, and the city said no, then the district would not annex those lands and allow them to develop unless the city consented to it. So if they said for some reason, and I don't really know why they would, if they said for some reason no, I mean, these are intended to come into the city someday, they could still consent to annexation into the district, and we would allow that, but not without their concurrence.
Okay.
The other situation outside of that, Greg, is if a property is not in a city's urban growth management area or within their comprehensive plan, but they are contiguous, you know, it's just, they're just sort of out there, and they're contiguous with the boundary, with the current district boundary. They're basically right there, and sewer is available. Even if they're proposing to develop like a small land division or something like that, there's really nowhere for them to go. And so we don't want to hold those properties up from being part of the sanitary sewer service area, really, because a lot of times they're in the urban area, they're on septic, and they're not connected to sewer. But that's a pretty limited circumstance. And I even tried to find some of those. We know they're out there, but I can't find one. So,
and I assume in that instance, they can't develop to a city urbanized standard. If they're not within an urban growth management area, then they're not going to have the zoning to go density. So they're going to be R20 or R40 or whatever those big lots are. And that's a different situation but going back, I assume the two pictures you showed us are in somebody's urban growth management area.
Yes. One of them certainly is the property off of Jennifer. I'm not entirely sure. I had a conversation with Anna earlier today, and we're still sort of sorting out whose urban growth management areas are where. But one of the reasons we wanted to provide that as an example is that is an area well within the urban area, surrounded by urban development, that is in our district, right, and connected to sanitary sewer, and so reasonably should be connected. It's just a matter of how to make that happen.
Okay, thank you.
Chris, did you want to add on to that?
Just a few clarifications, but Ron, that was a great answer and super specific and just well done. I did want to make the distinction between county zoning and West Service, in that whether they are zoned or not, someone, when they apply to us, they make a separate application for annexation into West. and we are able to make an evaluation at that time of the appropriateness of the service. And as Ron flagged, we, in our rules, are going to have the policy that they have to be within a city to receive that service with those certain limited exceptions. And I think there's one more, which is if they have a failing septic system and they're within 300 feet of the existing line, and then by state law, we have to allow them to connect to the sewer. We can also try and mandate that they annex into the city, and we've actually had conversations with the city around connection agreements. You know, if they're not contiguous with the city's jurisdictional boundary, but they're annexing in because of that instance, that they would basically file in the real property records an agreement that when the city actually reaches out to their property, that they will then annex into the property. We have basically since it was actually an issue originally raised by Happy Valley in, I think, 2007-ish, 2008. We have conformed to a policy of only allowing that urban level development to occur within a city to the best that we can. And the other caveat I want to throw out there is, however, annexation into West is, you might say, our primary lever or gateway for ensuring that to happen. So if someone has already annexed their property in but not yet developed, we don't have the ability to withhold service.
Thank you.
And that second map you showed, Ron, is actually in the Pleasant Valley North Carver comp plan, which has gone through two hearings with the Planning Commission and was going to go before the City Council in Happy Valley, but it's probably going to be on hold due to potential litigation. So, this whole thing is a bit of a quagmire. So, yeah, we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, it's really, you know, again, we're excited about just having it in our rules and regulations, and so it's a matter of taking our practice that we've been doing over years, as Chris just laid out, and trying to write it into the rules in a way that makes sense. So, is there any other questions?
This is a living document, right? I mean, it can be changed down the road. I mean, we're just trying to get the big things wrapped up here, and
And it's a barely breathing document right now. I mean, we're still working on it, but once we do. Get it through the board adoption process, it's absolutely a living document. You know, right. We will adjust as we go.
Okay. Moving on to.
I think William might have a question.
William, sorry, I got to look up here.
I was just curious if we are ready for a motion.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Ron's got to go through 3 and 4 on his list.
I'd take one, but I think I have a couple more.
No, do your diligence.
Okay. And William, I did get your message on the typo on that slide. I will address that. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Next slide. So these, I think, should be relatively quick. We did talk last time about system development charge financing, which is really our provisions and our rules that allow for SDCs to be paid in installment payments. We talked a little bit last time about SDC deferrals, which are a clear thing. This is the provisions that we have about allowing someone to pay SDCs in installments. And so our current issue, and we do have a section in our rules now, is that there really are no limits on the types or amounts of SDCs that can be financed. And so that creates some issues for us. One is a large hit on our staffing resources to do things like creating financing agreements, due diligence, collecting payments when people don't pay on those installments, but also some cash flow interruptions if we're talking about large sums of money. We right now allow for installment payments of SDCs over a 10-year period for really all project types and sizes. We get, you know, Aaron can talk more about what we actually see in terms of requests for financing SDCs over time, but our intent is to try and put some sideboards on what we can actually allow for installment payments and for certain types of projects. And so we really are proposing to allow for installment payments for SDCs, any amount on the lower end. Right now we say two or more. I'm not really sure why. because this is also sort of a safety net for people that do need to connect and can't afford to, even if it's just for one connection or EDU. We're allowing for SDCs limited to residential, both single family and multifamily developments, assigned 10 or fewer EDUs. We did benchmark and look at a few other municipalities, including the county's policies, and some people set dollar limits. We're just more focused on, I think, up to 10 EDUs, SDCs for those is, we think, reasonable. Again, the installments, so this is the same, not to exceed 20 semi-annual installments. One of the questions that came up last time, and I believe it was from William, was about the interest rate that we would charge on those installment payments, and then also a broader question about interest rates really throughout our rules, you know, from a financial standpoint, to make sure it's really, I think the question was, and William, you can clarify if I'm wrong, really to make sure that, you know, the district's financial interests are first and foremost in being represented. So it was a good exercise for Aaron and I, through many conversations, to go back through the rules and review all of the places where we talk about interest, whether it's on delinquent payments on monthly user charges, or whether it's on installment payments on SDCs, or whether it's on reimbursement district interest for future connections to lines built by private parties. And so we've had some good conversations that really created a good opportunity for us to make more consistent what our policies are. So for this one in particular, on SDC installment payments, our current policy is that the interest will be at the current U.S. federal prime rate, paraphrasing. And Aaron felt, I think, that might be a little low. We looked at the county's policy on financing transportation SDCs, and their policy is the U.S. federal prime rate plus 2%. That's codified in the county's zoning and development ordinances. And I think Aaron felt that was fair and something that should work across time. So that's what we're now proposing in the rules. Federal prime plus 2. We talked about the option. I'll just throw it out there. We talked about the option of really putting the interest rate that we would apply to SDC installments as well as others into our fee table that is adopted by the Board of County Commissioners by resolution on sort of an ongoing payment on an ongoing basis, and thought that might be a good way to sort of adjust with the times. But then also felt at the same time that was just sort of too vague, you know, what it doesn't really say what our policy is, that sort of says the interest rate will be whatever the interest rate is. And so for the SDC installment payments, we're proposing now the federal prime plus 2%. And again, overarching, that aligns with our original intent, which is really just to finance some smaller residential connections to make sure that people can connect. It aligns that interest rate with the county's policies on SDCs for transportation fees, and it reduces our financial risk and administrative cost if we put some sideboards on it. So that's the intent here. Are there any questions or thoughts on that overarching policy?
Just a clarification a little bit, Ron, is that I think when you're making that message to our customers, that we need to point out we're not out to gouge more money out of the developers or anyone else, frankly, but we want to make sure that we're not losing money by offering them this convenience.
Yeah, that's a great point. And something I think Aaron brought up too, as she was helping me understand, is, you know, this is really, we also don't really want to be competitive with banks and bank rates. And so we want it to be accessible, and for people that might not be able to get loans to pay for these, really again as a safety net, but at the same time not compete with other lending sources. So that made a lot of sense to me.
Anyone else?
I hate to shift in the middle of the stream here, but when I was writing that question down, I found one that I didn't ask before, and it's just something that I want to be clear on when we were talking about rates. Now, I think Mr. Story pointed out the fact that we set sideboards on those rates as well. But a couple of times it was mentioned that we set the minimum was to inflation. As I recall, the minimum was actually tagged to some industry standard. I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, it's an inflationary index that looks at construction, the engineering statement of inflation.
Yeah, so it's not the federal inflation rate.
Unfortunately, that one's worse.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I agree it is. I just want to be clear when we talk about what that lower limit is that we're calling apples apples.
Okay, Ron, I think you can go on to number four.
All right, next slide, please. So very similar, and I'll recap what we're proposing on reimbursement districts. We don't currently have the authority in our rules and regulations to establish reimbursement districts for property developers who have to build offsite improvements to connect to sanitary sewer just because they're not next to it. And it allows for them to recuperate the cost of constructing that infrastructure for future connections. Pretty much most other municipalities do have this authority. Happy Valley, right now we're actually working with Happy Valley to allow them to set up reimbursement districts for some wastewater infrastructure until such a time where we have this authority if the board approves it. So again, this is a new policy. We're basically, it's just really any future property that's benefiting from infrastructure that was built by a private party and is included in a board adopted by resolution reimbursement district that would have a reimbursement charge. They have to pay the district that charge at the time of their connection, and the district would pass per the agreement that those funds belong to the private developer. We do have a provision in that section as well, allowing for installment payments that are authorized. And we've made that section, because it wasn't when this came up before, we have made that section consistent with our SDC installment payment sections. So it's the same sort of time frame, payment options, and interest on that reimbursement charge that would be due. There's another interest rate that is mentioned in the reimbursement district section in the rules, and that's interest charged on the interest on the reimbursement charge. So when it gets set up, a developer would submit to the district an application for a reimbursement district and would say, this is how much it cost us to build this line. And then that would be divvied up among all of the properties that may connect to it in the future. And then that reimbursement charge would be charged to each of those properties. And there is a provision to allow for interest on that reimbursement charge. We are leaving that open in the rules currently in this section, saying that the district that West would recommend to the board in that reimbursement district application an interest rate on that reimbursement charge at the time they go to adopt it. I think that's consistent with what we've seen in other municipalities that have this authority, and it allows us to sort of be flexible with the time. So kind of while I said before, we don't want to leave too open-ended of a question, it does seem to make sense, at least in terms of the interest on the reimbursement charge, to have that be set by the board at the time the resolution would be adopted. And I can show a quick example on the next slide, Lauren. So this is an area where this is Hagen, Southeast Hagen Road, 172nd on the right and 162nd on the left, and the Scouters Mountain residential subdivision development had to build that sanitary line down Hagen Road to connect into the 172nd Avenue system. So this would be an example where they couldn't do it currently with West's rules and regulations, where the private developer in this situation could set up a reimbursement district for properties that would connect to this line in the future and be reimbursed for those connections. It's key to note that West has a separate connection charge for connecting to local infrastructure to pay for lines that West built, which would obviously not be charged in situations like this where there's a reimbursement charge that's going to a private developer because West didn't build the line. So we wouldn't seek reimbursement there. But I just kind of wanted to provide a visual. It's these offsite improvements that somebody has to build to connect to the sanitary sewer system and then allows for them to recoup future, recoup costs through future connections up to a limited period of time. We do say in the rules that's up to 10 years. And then after that, we are limiting it to that time frame. Next slide. I guess I should say on the reimbursement district, are there any questions on the reimbursement district proposal and any sort of charges around that? Just kind of came up along with the interest rate conversation last time. So thank you. I think that came up from William. So we had a good opportunity to make that more consistent. I appreciate that feedback. Okay, next. So again, there's still a lot to do. You know, we're still reviewing our key policy proposals with you. We are seeking your concurrence on at least the directions so that we can continue to write the words. Words matter. And so we're continuing to write the rules and standards to meet the intent of those of the policies we're proposing to you. A rough timeline, kind of depending on what happens tonight, where we would start to schedule policy sessions with the county commissioners to have public conversations around these key policy proposals and get their concurrence as well. And at the same time, continue to work on the final documents. We just brought a consultant on board to do a full technical edit of the rules in the design standards document, which we haven't had documents, I guess I should say, which we haven't had yet. So there's still a lot of writing to do and then push towards, you know, the summer time frame, June, July for adoption hearings, at which time the full documents will be available for review and comment, and people can read all the words and make sure we're actually meeting the intent of these proposed policies, and then seek implementation later this year if the county commissioners adopt the ordinances. Next slide. So again, bringing us back to the recommendation, we're asking that the advisory committee concur with our proposed key policy changes as presented for the rules and standards, and recommend that we move forward and engage the board in ordinance adoption.
So moved.
We have a motion from William. Do we have
second.
A second?
I'll second it.
Second from Greg DiLoretto. Thank you. Ron, I can't fathom the number of hours you've put into this. I bet you haven't kept count either.
It's been a while. It's been a lot, but we're getting closer. And staff throughout the organization have spent more hours than they really ever thought they would. So we're getting closer. I appreciate that.
You've done an excellent job, and you've made it very easy to understand too, because it got very technical at some points too. So we have a motion. We have a second. Do we have any other discussion before I move to a vote? All right. Can we do thumbs up again? And I know that some people don't have their cameras on, which is fine. But if you could unmute if you're a nay, that would be very helpful. All righty. Motion carries. And
thank you so much.
Ron, you get to move this forward to the Board of County Commissioners. Awesome.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Greg, do we have anyone for public comment tonight?
Lauren, I would look to you. No? No. Yeah, well, so thank you very much for that. And I will say, like, we've spent a lot of time on the rules and regulations in particular. Lynn and her group have spent a lot of time building the foundation for the financial projections that we're talking about and approved, and thank you for that. I'm hopeful that we can stick to the timeline that we're hoping for with the board. But this is a complete rewrite of the rules. And so I just want to set expectations that we may, you know, need to spend some time with the Board of County Commissioners, as we have with you, to walk them through things and do that type of thing. So, but overall, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, everyone from Wes, who put so much time into this. It's great work. Anyone else? Comments, questions, suggestions? No?
Third Thursdays, huh?
Second Thursdays.
Second, sorry. Third.
Second.
Yeah.
Second.
You'll send me a memo.
Yeah. I messaged Lauren and asked her to send out a memo to everyone with the dates for the rest of the year so that we can update our calendars. I know I'll need that.
Will we be going back to face-to-face meetings, or are we continuing in this mode?
Oh, that's a good question.
That is a good question, because that will change, I know, timing for some people, and then also room availability for us as well. So we would want as much advance notice if we are going to do all or some in person.
What are you seeing with other committees, Greg? I know that Sunrise is going to start meeting again in person this next month. So,
yeah, so I'm on the Oregon City Business Alliance and the Rotary Club, and we're meeting in person, but it's also hybrid. And that's kind of what we're doing here at WES, where we have a hybrid schedule. So I guess my thinking is that I would love to get together in person, and I think we should at the next meeting, and that we offer a remote option.
Especially for Chris.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we're going to make him fly home for this one.
I mean, to me, this is how we're going to be working moving forward. You know, like, we have this opportunity, like, we can meet in person, and we have this technology, and we've gotten used to it for the last 2 years, where we can bring in people that otherwise couldn't be there. That's just going to be how we do things. So
Angel has her hand up.
Hi, I guess I had a question. You know, the city of Milwaukee, of course, we are in person, have been for the last few meetings, but we are offering hybrid as well. For the same reasons that Greg, you just mentioned, I wondered, isn't there actually a requirement that we offer hybrid for public meetings? I mean, we were under the impression that actually we are required now to.
That sounds good. If we aren't, I agree. We should be.
Yeah. I don't know, but that sounds good to me too. Is that a state requirement or?
You know, I haven't even had time to actually dig into it. It was just something that was brought up at one of our meetings. And it was just our policy and our direction from our council anyway, because I think it makes good sense.
Yeah, to me, it's just a best practice.
So when we were in person, we were 6:30 to 8:30 because some folks had travel time. So is that still sounding good to start at 6:30?
Let's do a thumbs up.
Sure.
I prefer a 6 o'clock start time, but yep. I don't know how people, if that's a burden on some people to get there by six. Well,
if it's going to be physical, I'm imagining they're going to be serving meals again. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, we can do that. We'll just have to try and get, in advance, who's going to be
RSVP, yeah.
In person.
All right, let's go with six. Any objections?
Are you guys okay with six?
Yep.
Okay, good. Yeah. Good. All right, anything else? All right, this meeting is adjourned. It was nice to see everyone, and next time maybe we'll see you in person.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Good night.